Do I have a thing? Could I? Oh, okay.
Ish.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as you can be with a microphone.
Hi, thank you all for coming this evening to a panel discussion in collaboration and in concert with the Dorothea Tanning Early Designs for the Stage exhibition. We decided to organize this panel to look at the intersections between visual art, performance, and dance, and focusing on the collaboration between Tanning and Balanchine and the specific project that Tanning did in the 1940s and 50s. We're thrilled to have Anne Temkin, Robert Greskovit, and Anna Fink here to share their expertise with us and allow a little bit of insight into the exhibition and into dance. Sorry, I'm Rachel Leibowitz, and this is Joanna Kleinberg. We co-curated the exhibition here.
I'm just gonna do a quick introduction to our panelists this evening. Anne Temkin is the Marie-José and Henry Kravis Chief Curator of Painting and Sculpture at the Museum of Modern Art. In 2000, Anne organized the exhibition Birthday and Beyond at the Philadelphia Museum of Art to commemorate the museum's acquisition of Tanning's iconic self-portrait. Robert Greskovit is a freelance writer and dance critic for the Wall Street Journal, and he's also written a very insightful essay in our Drawing Papers exhibition catalog. And Anna Fink is the wardrobe supervisor for the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. She's been designing costumes for MCDC since 2007, creating five original works for the event series at Dia Beacon and costumes for nearly 90 Squared. So I'm gonna give it over to Anne, and welcome.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for being here. The curators have structured the panel, I think, very well, with us each having a different angle. And my angle is setting up Dorothea in general, apart from the work that you see across the street. In fact, when Brett Littman first proposed the exhibition to her, she was very reluctant to think about the works for Balanchine being on view, because in some ways they were what she felt to be, and it's true, quite unrepresentative of her career as a whole. But I think the Drawing Center managed to convince her that in their own way, these were incredibly interesting to look at and pointed to so many issues beyond their own physical objects. The thing that I will do is just give you a little background about what she was doing at the same time to situate the way those look vis-a-vis her painting. They were done, the Balanchine collaborations, as you know, from the mid-40s to the mid-50s. So it was a period of great, great intensity on her own part in terms of painting, and amazing breakthroughs kind of one after the other in various ways. The first breakthrough painting, as all of the books tell you and as legend now has it really, is this painting Birthday, which was, as she says, her real birthday, the painting of it, the meeting of Max Ernst in her apartment when it was on her easel, and the way in which that painting set her off in the New York art world at the Julian Levy Gallery with the people circulating around Peggy Guggenheim at Art of the Century, the whole group of exiled French artists and other European artists in New York City during the war. This was the period that she really came into visibility, having already been in New York for several years and working commercial jobs like illustrations for places like Macy's. So it's interesting with the work across the street that one thing that she draws on, no pun intended, is that experience as a draftsperson for commercial purposes, that, you know, again, it had the Drawing Center asked to show those works, or certainly various authors have asked her, oh, could we see some of those ads you did? You know, she's not interested in that being what she's connected to. But the talent and the skill and the kind of imaginative tone of them, for me, is an important precedent to these. And I didn't have a slide for the reasons I just told you. But here is Birthday, where you see, obviously, this self-portrait of her as half woman, half creature. And then the next slide. This is a painting that we just acquired this spring at the Museum of Modern Art. It's a painting that becomes the first work, the first painting by Dorothea in the collection. We do have prints by her for some time. But this painting is from 1948, so this would be after her first collaboration with Balanchine, made out in Arizona. And the imagery of it recalls very directly the house that she and Max Ernst built with their own four hands for themselves out there. And so this combination of reality and fantasy that pervades her work from start to finish is very clearly there. And the next. That's done. That's the end of my advertising acquisitions of Dorothea Tanning that I've made. I hope you can see this well. This is a painting I put up here because it does connect, I think, very closely to those first ballet drawings, with these incredibly fantastic costumes on this whole tower of girls in a dark hallway. And the next. And then again from 1948, so all in the same moment, this incredibly very happy picture where you have this feeling of dance and this feeling of motion, which is, for me, one of the things that makes this a really great, great Dorothea Tanning. It's at the Pompidou Center. Next. She moves to Paris with Max Ernst in the 50s, which is a whole next 30 years of her life, basically. The 50s, 60s, and 70s are spent mainly in France, either in Paris or the south of France. And the imagery gets a little darker. And she's painting pretty much in isolation there. She's not part of a circle anymore. And well, the same was true in Arizona. And she and Max are really the dialogue that she's able to have for painting. Always women as the subject of her paintings, or almost always, and yet always strange creatures that you can't quite identify as human or as non-human. But again, if you look at these, it's interesting how balletic it is when you're sitting here in relation to the show across the street, which is not something that otherwise, I think, would have been commented on in a painting like this. And the next one, Some Roses and Their Phantoms, a work in which, as in many, there is a rose as a kind of leitmotif, but also the dog. And I'm too dumb to know what kind of dog it is. Pam, you can maybe help me. If you knew, yeah, the hairy dogs that you can't see their eyes, not a sheepdog, a more exotic dog than that. Someone knows and will yell it out at some point. But these dogs were alter egos for her and populate her paintings again throughout the years. And for her, this, I don't think you need to know much about the history of mid-century art. This is so out of whack with what the movements of that moment would have been in France as well as in New York. Abstraction is really what was on everybody's lips and on everybody's easel, who was making it into galleries, making news in magazines and so forth. And yet she was very adamantly clinging to this imagery that allowed a narrative, never a really clearly understandable narrative, but a narrative that, in a surrealist fashion, because that remained her formative influence, spun some kind of mysterious atmosphere that gave people a sort of starting point for whatever the painting's content needed to be imagined. But as you can, I think, fairly well picture at the time these would have looked like paintings from Mars for the people who were around her, much, much more so than they do today, when the pluralist kind of possibilities of figuration or abstraction or the borderline between the two just are so much richer than when back at that time it was still a very dogmatic, you do this or you do that. But again, with this sense of fantasy, with this sense of being able to conjure with incredibly strong technical skill and amazing confidence, both in terms of draftsmanship but also the palette, that's what Balanchine kind of seized upon, I think, with her, and was able to imagine that she could, almost with a sort of magical pulling a rabbit out of hat kind of gift, make something for these ballets that was going to lift them from being merely, pedestrian. And the next one, still in the same moment of the ballets, The Philosophers. The picture is oftentimes very dark in terms of what's implied in regard to the fate of a young woman, implied violence, implied psychological violence. And the next. And then basically toward the end of the 50s, she does go more abstract and she does shift the scale to a larger scale. This is a very big picture. This is at the Moderna Museum in Stockholm. And you still see, however, the bodies kind of struggling through those clouds, not in a cubist sort of way, but more in this, in a surrealist way, the sense of physical engagement in all of that misty, crystalline form is never lost when you look at it. And obviously with the title, you get the sense of the disquiet and the nervous making. So I think that's one thing that's interestingly not so transferred into the ballet drawings, the sense of anxiety, the sense of foreboding that is so much a part of many of the works of the period that she was doing it. For the ballet, it became much more a party, and I'm sure that was partly the spirit of everybody working together at that time. Then I just gave you two or three pictures from the next decades. This obviously goes beyond the time period of when she's making the works for Balanchine, but the pictures continue to be very large, even more abstract. The Descent into the Street, obviously a 1968 Paris scene, but instead of photographs of demonstrators or something like that, you just have these fabulous forms that tangle and tumble with each other all over the painting. Notice also in the 60s a palette change that is, to me, extremely beautiful into these sort of purple, eggplanty, burgundy, golden tones that characterize a lot of the paintings of that moment. And then her last few years in Paris, still going strong, back to figuration. Notes for an Apocalypse, obviously, still with those very dark implications of struggle, of trying to work something out. And next. Finally, just giving you a quick look at what she was doing also in that last decade that I think interestingly relates to the ballets, because of course in terms of thinking about costume, she was a great seamstress, and she did like to make sculptures from fabrics that at that time were something that would not have been considered a viable sculptural material, just fabric and thread and stuffing. But she made a body of work that, again, over time has come to look incredibly impressive, even though at that moment, this is the moment of Carl Andre and Donald Judd and so on, Richard Serra, it would have looked strange and probably feminine. The next. Here's a sculpture that relates very directly to the paintings, with the human body twisting in a little corner of kind of self-involvement. And finally, the rainy day canapé, which is made of upholstered tweed material. But really, I think looking at the sculptures in combination with those last, say, 20 years of paintings, it really makes clear the entanglement of abstraction and figuration in the way that, not that the couch is abstract, but the way that bodies can just come in and out of space and acquire volume almost seemingly momentarily and then lose that volume again mysteriously. And I think all of that is a brilliance that obviously is far more complicated than what shows up in the Balanchine drawings. And yet the connection is not completely without lots of overtones that she brought from, certainly from this work to the other. What she brought from that work to this is something I was trying to think about a little bit earlier, and not so sure what the answer would be on that. Maybe you guys would have some thoughts on it. But I know from speaking with her that the Balanchine work was really a diversion. She loved doing it, and it was probably somewhat relaxing in the way that all this was somewhat more of a serious enterprise. And yet it was something that Balanchine loved the results of. Obviously, he asked her to do another and another after the first, even though these ballets weren't popular successes, to say the least. And she remembers it as a great experience. Thanks.
Well, I didn't know any of that, so thank you. I'm coming from my ballet perspective. I can give you some sense. I never saw the Night Shadow in those designs on stage, because when the New York City Ballet brought it back in 1960, and there's a very touching letter there that in Tanning's hand to Balanchine's company manager, Betty Cage, and she has noticed in the advertisements, I guess, the brochures, that the Night Shadow is coming back. And she says, does it look nice, and will you be using my sets and costumes? And of course, they were not. I don't know what the politic was to change them to Esteban Francis, which were deadly dull, in my opinion. Beige nothingnesses, but nobody asked me. So to this day, I've never seen them on stage, but I've always been fascinated by photographs and by hearing about them. I was lucky in those days that I was at New York City Ballet from about 1969, and certainly now, still there, but till Balanchine died in 83, to make the acquaintance of Edward Gorey, who was very fascinated by designers and painters like Tanning. And I don't think he ever saw The Night Shadow. I know he greatly regretted not having seen it, and he always wanted to. But he reminded me, as a choreographile, as I think we might have been called in those days, when the choreographer was everything, that there was a period, and it was when he was being brought into the ballet, when the designer was everything. You didn't say who choreographed it, you said who designed it. And he ran off to the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, I think the first time, because Dali had designed a ballet, I think Labyrinth, it could have been Bacchanal, but I'm not sure. Anyway, his first ballet he was going to see was to see Dali, not to see Leonid Massine or anybody else. Gorey ended up loving Balanchine, of course, but he went initially through that route of the designer and the painter. And I gather that in Tanning's, I don't have a copy of it, autobiography, she notes that she met Balanchine at the Julian Levy Gallery setting, but she was introduced to him by Eugene Behrman. Now, if you know Behrman's work, it's related, but I would say it's more decorative. Would you? How would you? Yeah. Right now, the New York City Ballet is, by the way, performing a ballet of Balanchine's with some rather interesting Behrman designs, which did last, unlike Tanning's designs, if you want to see them there on a piece called Danse Concertante this very season. In any case, as far, Balanchine was never very forthcoming, shall we say, certainly not to me. I remember once he was asked in public about inviting to his company maybe sort of left-field people like, well, you invited Merce Cunningham and Martha Graham to be part of New York City Ballet Repertory at one point. Can you tell us about that? And he looked at his questioner and he said, friends of Lincoln's. That, of course, Lincoln being Lincoln Kirstein, who I suspect might have had a strong connection to Tanning, because in Duberman's biography of Lincoln Kirstein, he mentions that when Lincoln Kirstein was helping Balanchine organize Ballet Society, a one-year subscription organization that preceded this founding of the New York City Ballet, Dorothea Tanning was one of the painters that he mentions wanting to commission for Ballet Society. Now, that commission never happened, probably because there was no budget to do it. But the plan was for what Tanning and Pavel Chelichev called the horsey ballet. It was going to be called Favorite and be set at a racetrack. I don't know if any sketches were even done. I certainly haven't seen them. But in any case, I have a feeling she had a connection to Kirstein. So this era that she started working in with Balanchine was when Balanchine was not his own boss. He was working for Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, where the idea of the set and the setting and the costume was expected in a kind of European tradition. Now, Balanchine's own company has a reputation, I think, people nowadays think of as the black and white company, the place where you'll see ballets on bare stages with simple cyclorama backgrounds, and they'll be wearing, if you're lucky, specially cut t-shirts with their jeans, and the women will wear leotards and pink tights. It's become almost something of a cliché, because in fact Balanchine, as a product of the imperial tradition in Russia, and then the early Soviet traditions, was from a theater tradition that was very much about stage decoration. And in fact, his canon, if you look at it carefully, doesn't only have black and white or plain stage ballets. It has a number with goodly chosen decor and costumes. Balanchine wanted those things to be, when they were needed, as elaborate as possible. He is said to have thought over the years, when people begged him to please do a Sleeping Beauty, the great 1890 work from the Mariinsky in St. Petersburg. And he often said he wanted to, but only with the right facility and the right budget. And one of the things that showed his theatrical savvy, I think, was he wanted a stage that had at least six wings, because the prologue scenario to the Sleeping Beauty involves six good fairies, and Balanchine wanted each fairy to enter from her own wing. Now, traditional stages in Europe have six wings. They're deep. Ours tend to have four. So in his mind, he didn't want to make that compromise. So I think it's a myth to say that because you might see a lot of undecorated dances at the New York City Ballet in Balanchine's era, that he didn't like or want sets. I think he couldn't have the ones that he ideally wanted at times, so he would have none. Now, Kirstein liked to make, I think, a philosophy of a necessity. And I recently found this rather odd statement of his. I found it because the New York City Ballet this year has a festival called the Architecture of Dance. And they have invited Calatrava, the architect from Spain, to do some collaborations with current choreographers. And there's a tradition that Peter Martins at New York City Ballet today points to, that Balanchine had a unit set for himself in 1981 for his Tchaikovsky Festival. It was a Philip Johnson idea. It was all plexiglass tubes. It was called an ice palace or an ice cathedral. And it was supposed to be able to be rearranged in multitudinous ways and be a marvel. Well, it didn't turn out to be so marvelous, but anyway, that's what they used. And in order to promote this as a great idea, Kirstein was quoted in the essay as saying, "The New York City Ballet has often been accused of being uninterested in stage design." He answers, "It's true. we're not. I don't know who this we is, but I guess he's not, or he's not for this particular interviewer. We're interested in steps in dancing. That was true, but it wasn't only true, I feel. And collaborations like, or at least the use of tanning, proves to me that it wasn't. He says, an intrusive set competes with dancing. The backlot strays. It's a set sits. And then he's trying to promote what they want. He says, light is kinetic. We always try to work with light. Paint can't move. Well, whether or not Tanning's costumes could move or not, they were obviously in the great dances that begin the Night Shadow. And the thing I have never had anybody answer for me, never having seen it, is there's a stage direction today. Night Shadow has become La Sonnambula, same libretto, same music, same choreography, in which the flirtatious guests, one after another, pair up, and the women remove their masks. Now, if you've been across the street, you can see that some of these masks are pretty elaborate. And I don't know whether that removing the mask happened in Tanning's designs, whether maybe they were removed before the dance in which we now see them remove them, or what. But anyway, I have not found a record of what happened at that moment. But certainly her masks are fantastical and riveting and very imaginatively built as well as designed. Do we know who built those costumes, by the way? I don't know if the program tells us that. But they are rather wonderfully built. The ironic thing, I'm trying to go a little bit off Tanning, I guess, again here, is that once Balanchine died, Kirstein got back in a kind of driver's seat, which is another reason why I think Balanchine probably wasn't the easiest person to collaborate with. I think you took direction or you just shut your mouth. And the minute Balanchine was dead, Kirstein helped Balanchine's successor, Peter Martens, redesign three of Balanchine's productions. Liebeslieder Walzer in 1984, which had a very simple set in its original manifestation, got a very elaborate one by David Mitchell, based on the Amalienberg in Munich, which is a loosed house of the one of the electresses of that Rococo period. And then Gounod's Symphony in 1985 got a new set of designs by Robin Wagner, also under Kirstein's direction, and very much based, I realized a few years later, on what Chelyachev had designed for Balanchine in 1942. And then a ballet called Brahms-Schoenberg Quartet, which is still on the boards, as is Liebeslieder Walzer. And that was redesigned to look in a painted backlot as if the Schönbrunn Palace were in the background. So Kirstein, who told the whole world in 1981 we're not interested in sets, became very interested in sets once Balanchine died. I don't quite know what to make of that, but I can just tell you I think it's true. I made a list of the dances after Tanning's last work for the company, which was in 62. And Balanchine made A Midsummer Night's Dream, a two-act ballet with both sets and costumes of a fairly elaborate order by David Hayes. He did A Noah and the Flood, and that was his first collaboration with Ruben Terartunian, who became the house designer. The one thing Tanning was not was obviously the artistic or the art world designer. And I don't know whether her not being able to be around a lot was maybe a drawback to using her again. One story, I don't know if she knows, she read it, but the biography of John Cranko, Cranko's ballet, The Witch, which you can see designs from over there, was shown only in London, and then it disappeared, partly because it was a music rights problem. But in any case, Cranko's biographer tells a story of going to Paris to visit Tanning and her husband. That's all Cranko knew. And her husband gave him a signed poster when he left. and as he was packing, it didn't fit in the suitcase. And so he had to just leave it or throw it out, and he didn't realize until years later he had thrown out a Max Ernst. So I wonder if that would maybe please Tanning to know that she wasn't Mrs. Max Ernst. She was Dorothea Tanning, and he was just her husband at that time. So basically, I don't know if Tanning went much to the ballet after her designs were no longer used, but if she did, she would have seen that Balanchine and his company certainly had a use for both costume and sets. David Mitchell, who, as I say, was brought in by Kirstein, worked with Balanchine as an assistant before he died, and told me, I interviewed him about his work for the Steadfast Tin Soldier, for example. And I said, that fire is so wonderful. There's a fireplace in it, if you've ever seen it, and a soldier and a ballerina doll are standing in front of it. And it just looks ablaze. I said, that fire is so marvelous. And he said, that wasn't me, that was Balanchine. He said, oh, in Russia, all you need is a big piece of silk. Don't make little shreds, make big. So it's this big piece of orange silk and a fan and an orange light, and it's quite impressive. Which Mitchell's point to me was, Balanchine knew his theater, he knew his theater mechanics, he knew his theater design through and through. And as I said, Berman introduced Balanchine to Tanning, and he must have realized that her imagination would take fire in a similar way. So, as I say, I never met her, so I don't know much more than that.
When we were told we were going to be talking about collaborations, I had a momentary panic, because who wants to collaborate? You never want to have these things that you create judged by someone else that you have to put together. But in thinking back, you also have that opportunity. Maybe you get to collaborate with someone great like Balanchine, or maybe it's somebody new that you have to research a little bit and figure out, okay, does the tone of their work have the same resonance that mine does? Do we want it to work together? And you hope that this, when you finally start, that it's eye-opening and you're going to learn something about it. And so I'm sure, like with Tanning, she met Balanchine at a party, and you know, a friend of his had seen her works and said, well, I know you need a new designer for your ballet, and we do know Balanchine is lights and tights. Like, that's what we describe him as, because a lot of his things are very stark, so you can see the work, which Merce is likened to also. But their collaboration, I'm sure, started over a cocktail and a few minutes of mingling, and then she went home and, okay, you need a bird or a witch, and so she made these beautiful sketches next door and, you know, brings them back in. And I can't imagine, it would take a very easygoing ballerina to look at these sketches and want to perform in them. Well, they're beautiful for us to look at, but as a dancer, you know, who wants to spot with tentacles flying around their head, or, you know, so, but perhaps if Balanchine really loved the sketch of the bird, maybe he changed a step or two so her beak wasn't hitting her partner in the head, you know, as they're walking around. But at Cunningham, we've done, not only with costumes, we usually do more with other visual artists. We did a run here in New York at the Joyce, and we did a run in Paris at the Opera House, and also different events here and there with local artists. And it's always, Merce was always interested in using these new artists, no matter how it turned out. And then it was up to us on the production side to figure out, okay, how are we going to make this work? You know, you get these artists who are used to doing something that you can hang in a gallery. They don't know much about the theater. And so they come in with these grand ideas, and you have to say, well, no, you can't be this, the stage can't be this dark to show your projection, because the dancers need to see each other. Or one artist wanted to have swinging light bulbs that would shatter against each other, and, you you know, our dancers are barefoot, so obviously that wasn't going to work. And so at the end of these, you know, production meetings, we had this feeling of, okay, we just escaped this horrible disaster, while they were going home thinking, well, I have to start over. You know, this was my idea, and now we have to change it. Because when you're creating something, you finally get to that moment where you're like, this is it. This is the shape, this is the color, this is perfect, I'm ready. And you have this child that you bring with to the meeting for someone else to accept. And then they say, well, this would work, but it won't fit on stage. Or this color's okay, but we can't get it exactly for this budget, so how about this? And suddenly what you created has been twisted in this spirit of collaboration. And, even with all of that, all of the things that could go wrong, everything that could have been thrown out, Merce was always ready to make things work. There was one, I think it was a big projection of a athletic field with all these things going on, and it filled up the whole psych. And I remember the dancers thinking that it overshadowed them, like, how are we going to be seen? What are the audience is going to be distracted? And Merce just sat there and he's like, well, there could be a basketball game going on, you just have to dance. And so they did, and that's what worked. So with Merce, the spirit of collaboration, like we were just talking about, is a little different because he believed that everything existed on its own. The music was just happening, and the dance is just happening, and if there's a decor, it's just there. They were never all brought together to be presenting the same idea. And so when I started designing, I was never given any input or direction. There were usually nothing at all that I had to go by other than not distracting from the line or hiding his work. Hence, if you know Cunningham, pretty much everything is in a unitard, which nobody really wants to wear. And so coming from a dance background, I wanted to design for them something they would feel more comfortable in. So one of the designs, I call the shadow, like every edge of them is darkened, so they felt a little skinnier. And I think a lot of them still like wearing those the best. But the next one I did, everyone had a different color with a different design on the torso. And I gave the colors that stood out most to the dancers that felt they stood out the least, so they would feel a little more confident, even though they're in the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. They're pretty good. Or another one was a metallic set with the sheen of the Lycra bringing out their muscles even more to make their lines look longer. And so for me, I felt like the only collaboration effort I was going to was more with the dancers to make them feel comfortable, and I had that availability because I've been touring with them for the last 6 years. The only real conversation I had with Merce was for the first design, and you know, I came to him with my sketches and I was terrified. I'm like, here's this legend I'm working for and I'm designing now. And the basic design is the tallest dancers are in a dark red, and as they get shorter it fades to an orange, and each person has a stripe horizontally that goes down their body. So I crossed the large studio with them, and he sits there and he looks at the sketches and he pauses and he's like, well, maybe we don't need the stripe. And I was like, well, that's the whole design, you know? Like, without that, like, anyone could come and go to Spandex House and pick out some colors and throw them on and call it a design, but it's not really designing. So I felt confident with my choice and the fabric I finally found after my fourth trip up there. And we went with it, and in the end, he thought it was beautiful, and I was asked to create 5 more sets, including the very last piece that he set on the company. And for that, the only direction he gave me was that it had to change at some point. And so it's a freeing feeling, but it's also terrifying because you're not given any direction, really. And I think with Merce, it wasn't that he didn't care, but he kind of liked to see what would happen when, okay, here's this person that's been trusted with this design, and what are they going to do with it? And the last piece that Robert Rauschenberg designed for us, called Crossover, he did this set, the backdrop and the costumes, and he chose a white unitard, which of course was horrible for me as the wardrobe supervisor and for the dancers, because you don't want to wear that. And I was already preparing my speech that I still give them every time we do it, like, please, if you're going to stretch on the floor, put the blanket down, don't wear lipstick, don't lean on anything, you know. And I'm just thinking of, okay, we're going to need 8 extra sets for each person, because who knows. And I went up to him, and we were just chit-chatting, and he's like, well, I hear Bob chose white. And I kind of nodded in defeat, and he's like, well, I guess I won't give them any floor work. And for that, I'm just still so grateful, you know, because otherwise they would have stained knees and everything. And of course, the one thing I've learned from being both a designer and the person who has to take care of it is to try to make things that are machine washable, which doesn't always happen. But with Merce, he never made strict demands, but I think he knew what he wanted so much, and so we knew the limitations and with which to work, and that has been a pretty amazing experience. And because it's difficult enough to create something, to show something you've done to an audience or to the board or to the presenter of where you're going to be. And it's even more difficult when that has to be accepted by someone else. Like, Merce could have said, well, no, I don't want to have this piece, you know. And there have been not many, but a couple times where we've edged a piece out very quickly because of one of the design elements weren't really right. And with all of the collaborations I've seen with the company, they're not always easy. And in Tanning's autobiography, there's only a couple paragraphs about her collaboration with Balanchine, but in the end she said it taught her that she had a basic distaste for it, because it is difficult. And yet she ended up doing 4 different ballets. And so there was that part, I think the pull of doing something different, something away from your own work, is always an interesting challenge that is brought to the table. And for the amount of annoyances we've had to deal with in the process, pretty much every time the curtain comes down, that is changed to, oh, thank you, and oh, isn't the piece beautiful? And you're just remembering how earlier you wanted to wring their neck because they insisted on doing this thing that was not the easiest. But in the end, you learn, you know, that this worked, or at least you have something interesting for your resume, and you know what you don't want to agree to in the future. But I think as an audience member, to see something that is a collaboration, it just gives you more to work with. You have more to take in as opposed to just one element. Like when someone is asked to design, you can see the design, and whether or not you like it, at least there's something more you can talk about, you know, when you're safely a few blocks from the theater, when no one is going to overhear what you thought. But I think with a collaboration, it gives you more to think about, and for that, all the better.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that so I can repeat it?
Yeah. You mentioned that New York City Ballet uses a lot of sets.
Right.
Do you know where they are?
I do not. That's a very good question. I don't know whether they have been preserved in any way. I also don't know if Kurinska had a hand in building them, because the famous builder of many New York City ballet productions, this was, of course, a Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo production, but I know she had some hand in that work. Sometimes her workshop kept these things, but I have never been given to understand or believe that they had been kept. The letters that are in that show are from Ballet Society's archive. It's just possible that the headpieces maybe survived or something, but I'm unaware that the... and I'm also unaware of why, when it came back in 1960, because obviously Tanning herself wasn't told she wouldn't again be put back on stage, that they went with Esteban Francis, who was another discovery of Kirstein's, and who was in that same list that Duberman has Tanning in when he lists the visual artists that Kirstein hopes to commission. Tanning is one, and Esteban Francis is another. And Esteban Francis designed a very elaborate production. He designed a number for Balanchine. As I say, I think that the Sonnambula is just god-awful. But he designed Balanchine's Don Quixote. And it's a little dry, but it's I find it is effective and has wonderful things, like a giant comes up as a big puppet behind the windmill and stuff. So a very elaborate stage effect. But I do not know, I don't know who would know. Did you ask Tanning if she knew it? Do you know if she had any hand in building them? You don't know.
I don't believe so. Does anyone else in the audience know? But the other thing that has happened over the years with other artists, I know, is things turning up in the strangest places. Like at Philadelphia, we had an enormous curtain. If you know the Philadelphia Museum, it still hangs when you walk in the building. This enormous Chagall that was for the ballet Aleko. And that turned up in Mexico like 40 years later, because I think the ballet was performed once in Mexico and nobody bothered shipping the stuff back, you know? And somebody found it literally in a box and said, I think this is a Chagall. So things like that do happen. I think it's probably not a totally closed case.
And they were all brought together for a show in Japan, the Aleko drops, about a year and a half ago. So things do turn up, it's true.
And at Cunningham, Merce passed away not quite a year ago, and we were cleaning out his office, and there are still so many pieces that we found, and a lot of John Cage's old weird music things that he had created that are worth so much just for that, you know, when you're working and at the time you're like, well, John will get this later, and you just shove it aside, and then something else gets pushed in front of it and more gets pushed in front, and suddenly, you know, maybe if City Ballet cleaned out everything, something might turn up, but until then you'll never know. So I think it's quite easy for things to disappear.
And then the other way they can turn up, I remember in the New York City Ballet and the New York City Opera had an annual bazaar where they sold things. And I remember Edward Gorey himself saying he could still kick himself to this day, because they were selling one of Kurinska's tutus from the Waltz of the Flowers from a previous production. She had redesigned them, and it was on a rack. You could buy it at a bazaar on, you know, your daughter too could be a Waltz of the Flowers girl for $10 or something. So before they were considered artifacts, they were considered, I guess, just something they could make a buck on. Any other questions?
Yes. It's like the Armenian machine that showed up after
2,000 years. I didn't see about it, but I heard about it. Yes, yes. Yes.
Question about the sculpture. You showed some of her, something
big. Like the one that's the sofa with the body coming out of it is what you might call life size. The same with the column, you know, maybe at least 5 feet. The pincushion, smaller, not a life size pincushion, but probably like that. They're in a variety of museums, actually. I think, Doug, are they almost all in museums now?
Where are we here?
The De Kellermoor, the column, is at the Pompidou, and the pincushion is at Tate Modern, and the rainy day canapé. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's not a big body of work. It's fewer than a dozen. Interesting, though, aren't they?
How hard can the curator tell, was it to put together that many of these designs? Did you have to scour the city, the earth, or?
We did contain things to Pam for the archive. We kind of come up with things and
my three photographs were on eBay. I can vouch for that because that's how I snagged them. Nobody knew they were there but me.
For Merce's last big work at BAM, we had a set design from Spain, and Romeo Gili did the costumes. And we had also a lighting designer and a projectionist, so that was a big to-do. Before that, for a couple of his new pieces, we kind of went the budgeted route of whoever did the drop would choose the color and the style of a solid-colored unitard. So they were credited with the design, but, you know, we just built very simplistic things to make do. Right. And a lot of times with when we have different visual artists, that's when we use the event costumes of the ones that I designed up for Dia Vegan can be used anywhere throughout the world whenever we do something with a different set of art. When the dance has a specific name and we're doing that dance, then it's always that format. But we do a lot of things, like we could put a show on in here where we just build a stage, and then that would be called an event. And we use different pieces of his old work that are made new each time to make a different event. And those are when we use an event costume. Right. For the most part, we've had a few, when we revive things, a couple times we can use the originals. Like for Roratorio, we just revived that in LA last week, and all of the original unitards except for one we used. So sometimes when they're not that gross polyester, we can use them and save a couple bucks.
Relationship to her painting.
Yes, that makes sense to me. Also, the tradition of sketches for costumes, right? But yeah, it's interesting.
Has anyone tried to find the painting of the Night Shadow Gothic locale? Does anyone know if it still exists anywhere? It fascinates me because it's so open. I know that when there was a third revival, I think, at New York City Ballet, second one after, I think Alan Baez did two for New York City Ballet after Estefan Francis. And the complaint by one of the more redoubtable Balanchine experts, Arlene Croce, was that it didn't have enough sky, and that at the end of La Sonnambula, the sleepwalker takes the murdered poet in her arms with her candle, and she reascends the stairs of her tower. And then eventually the light goes into heaven or into the sky, whatever. And the second and a half new set had so much architecture up there that there was no sky. And I realize in Tannings, there's a lot of sky, because the only real piece of architecture, basically it's a ruin, is that tower. So the light had plenty of room to float away. So she really did present that as an idea. Now, whether or not the staging of taking the light in the sky came because she provided sky, or was she told, give us sky, I can't say. But it's a magical moment, I always find, that light just goes and your mind goes and you think that is the sleepwalker and that is the spirit of the poet and they have ascended to nirvana. But I don't know where that painting is nowadays. I'd love to see it. I've only seen the reproduction from the catalog. That's it.
I think that's an interesting question, too, and we were talking about earlier who did create the costumes, who actually built them, and that information is a lot of times overlooked or lost because, yes, you had the designer who came up with the image, but who is the actual builder of the piece, which is not an easy task if you look at her sketches, and so I think that's an interesting thing that has been lost.
But as a seamstress, as we heard today, Tanning was, I suspect she probably had some real close contact with, are they building what she drew? Are they catching it as needle and thread work? Your question back there, yes. Anybody know if Tanning has seen the show? The answer is yes from three hairy heads. Now we get silence. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. She said, oh, she isn't what?
She said, oh, she's holding the
camera. Oh.
So she remembered that my tableau was mentioned, which value it was, which drawing it was. She also remembered very specifically all the meaning of the answer. So I think that for, in a way, the demonstrations of this body work outside of her other bodies, it did have an impact on the subject. That's awesome.
Although I suspect, as to the location of the costumes, once the company takes hold, the building, she would probably know. Yeah. The one costume that Balanchine kept consistently, once he revived it in '60, which was with André Levasseur's, in my opinion, not very distinguished designs, which came from some other company I never heard of, the sleepwalker's dress, which Tanning
designed so evocatively with those tassels was redone by Karinska with sort of diaphanous sleeves but no tassels. And I think the Balanchine Trust to this day says you can do a sonnambula any way you want. Well, not any way, but, you know, within reason. You may redesign it, but you may not redesign the sleepwalker's diaphanous gown. It must be the one that that Karinska did, which, as I say, doesn't have those, I think, fascinating tassels on them. But, yeah. But her hair is still streaming down. And in the opera La Sonnambula, she's described as having, I think, eyes of fire and hair streaming down as she makes her phantom appearance, which is part of the music that was used for this. Yes?
Not what's springing to mind for me. What about other tanning people in the audience? Other collaborative types, projects?
Theater.
And she was, I mean, not necessarily by choice, but by necessity as well, such an individualist. So it makes sense to me in a way that I mean, in fact, you know, it's unusual for an artist to be, it's involved in such things. We're hearing about the ones that happen, but it's a rarity, really.
Yes. Surrealism? Did she consider herself a surrealist? I'm asking the curator here.
Oh, yeah, I think she would admit to that being the tradition she worked in. I mean, surrealism was funny because it was one of the few movements or isms that really was sort of a card-carrying kind of club. And she didn't have a card in that way. But certainly that was the spirit she came into her own through, and she talks so much about seeing those initial shows at MoMA or at the Julian Levy Gallery and being marked by them. And the American brand of surrealism had its own distinct flavor and one that she really epitomizes. But I think even in these, you know, I use the word fantasy more than surrealism, but it's that same sort of openness to a sort of magical atmosphere that I think so.
That umbrella costume is interesting because in Dali's, is it Bacchanal, I think, Labyrinth, I think there are these walking umbrellas, but hers go out and that one went up, but that was earlier, Dali's umbrellas from hers.
Thank you.
like? Where are you going?
Montpellier.
Lovely to meet you. I'll look for you, Maxine.